Welcome to the latest episode of the Keeping Pace podcast. I'm your host, Mike Moreau. Brian Contreras is my latest guest. Brian and I caught up a little bit right before he headed to Scotland to run a marathon. We talk about the journey that has led to his active life, fitting it all in while finding quality time with friends and family, and also some cooking talk. Enjoy getting to know Brian.
Brian, how's it going? Thanks for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me, Mike. It's going well. Just, you know, a couple of weeks away from Chicago.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realize you were doing Chicago as well. I know we were just talking about you heading out to, is it Ireland?
Scotland. So
Scotland.
Myself and a buddy, Matt, are running the Loch Ness Marathon up in the Highlands of Scotland this weekend. Kind of using it as our last long training run for Chicago. But quickly on the tails of Chicago, on November 8th, we'll be running the Tunnel Hill 100 miler in Southern Illinois. So we're kind of double dipping with this Loch Ness Marathon. Last 20 mile workout, but adding a little 6.2 extra so we can fulfill our ultra training mileage.
The idea of training for an ultra just, I guess a 50K is like pretty close to marathon training.
That's what I've heard. And looking at the different, you know, training plans, it's very similarly to marathon training. They're definitely more intense about their rest days, but the active recovery is a huge part of it. So, you know, that back-to-back long run throughout the week and add on miles, the double days, I think are the keys there, which based on your Strava, I see you get a bunch of bonus mics. So,
yeah. I don't know if I've ever told the story of how that came about, but I used to just put bonus miles and it kept correcting to mics. So I just like, we're just going to go with this now.
I think it's an awesome brand. And quite honestly, you should probably make some merch because I 100% would subscribe to that.
Nice. I'll have to think about that. we jumped forward a little bit, just talking about future training, but just give a little mini intro about yourself. It doesn't have to be too long, just like where you're from, what you do, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So originally, I'm one of the few that, and I don't know if the next generation will get this reference, but I was born in East LA, but really moved out of LA with the family and extended family when I was two. So I don't remember much of that, but I was really born and raised, or I was raised, I would say, in Arizona. So I'm a desert rat. Split even time between Phoenix, Scottsdale area and Tucson. Went to college in Tucson at the University of Arizona. And then post-college, most of my time in Phoenix and Scottsdale. What I'll say from what I do is a very funny question, because for about 20 years of my life, I was in culinary. So executive chef, last position was a corporate chef for one of the large hospitality companies in the world, overseeing all hotels and restaurants from Canada down to South America. But in the more recent years, I took a little pivot after COVID. As you can imagine, the intenseness in the hospitality industry that COVID brought, I decided to shift, and I've been delving more into project management and corporate strategy. So that's kind of the dry piece of where I'd been creative for 20 years and working with teams intensely on delivering a really cool food experience. And then was like, let me sell my soul and do the corporate thing for a bit and see how that tracks.
That is a really interesting pivot. How did you originally get into the culinary part?
So I'll make a very long story short. I will say I had too much fun at the University of Arizona and needed extra money. I was valeting part-time just to have some income while I was at school. I needed more. And during the summers in Arizona, as you can imagine, 100, 120 degrees outside, you don't get a lot of tourists coming. So the valet gig was not as lucrative. And my friend had a prep cook position opened at a bar and grill that he was working at. And I just took it for some extra cash. Ended up really falling in love with the industry. After college, went to culinary school and the rest is kind of history.
Yeah. And I mean, not too dissimilar from your running. I feel like that industry is a little bit of a grind.
I will say there's like a bit of mental translation when it comes to distance running and culinary, because the amount of non-glamorous stuff that happens behind the scenes, and I can use, I'm going to get kind of nerdy on you, Mike, but like I'll use like a really great dinner service, right? Let's call it a special event. Dinner starts at 5:30 for most restaurants. When I was running restaurants, and specifically independent restaurants where you had a very slim staff, you know, it was a very tight-knit family, usually never more than, you know, 20 to 30 employees, 10 of which were in the kitchen with you. You're getting ready for dinner service at 7:30 in the morning, and you're working all the way through, and dinner service doesn't wrap until 12:30. So you've got this long grind before you even start to serve food. And it's always that metaphor for, you know, what I think of from a marathon training perspective. If you've got 14 to 16 weeks grinding that nobody really sees outside of, you know, if you're blessed and have that wonderful circle of friends that you run with, that community, nobody sees any of that work until race day. And that's very similar, is no one cares about how the sauce is made. The fact that it does take 2 days to do it. One of the recipes I was really known for back in when I was based in Austin was fried chicken, funny enough. But that fried chicken took 3 days to make it. And it was very highly regarded, very awarded recipe in the Austin area. But nobody knew that it took 3 days. They just came, and if we were sold out, we were sold out. And people lost their minds. But they also didn't understand the amount of work that, you know, myself and my team had to put into it. So it is a grind. And a lot of it goes, I would say, unthanked on the back end.
Yeah. I mean, I vaguely know some of that only because I do like to go out and eat. So you do hear about some of that stuff. But yeah, I think largely I would say you're right. Like nobody knows like how much work goes into it. Like you don't just show up and cook when the restaurant opens.
If it was that easy, I think more of us would do it.
So obviously we're going to talk a lot about running. So I'm curious, how did you get your start with the sport?
So it really actually goes back to high school, because I was always enamored with football growing up. As a kid, played flag football, and I played football freshman year of high school. And it was fun. It was great, but I realized it wasn't really for me. And I had some friends that ran cross country. So when spring came around, I was like, all right, like I'll run the mile and the half mile. And that was great. I come to find out that the half mile is probably the hardest, most painful race you could possibly pick. But was proud of that. And so did that for that season. But kind of set it off to the side as I kind of fell in love with men's volleyball and played that for effectively 7 years. So 3 years in high school and then 4 years in college, primarily intramurals in college. And I would run on and off through my 20s. I was in the kitchen a lot, so I didn't have a lot of time, but it was something that, you know, I would kind of lean into. And it was also around the same time that those mud races were like the jam. So whether it's the Tough Mudder, the Spartan race, or any of that stuff. So we would, you know, get in and get a group and go do those things. But I really didn't get into running in the way that I am now until COVID, which was a lot of, I think, how a lot of people got started. And really what it was I gained like 30 pounds during the peak of COVID. And I was at that point in my mid 30s, and I was like, I'll just, you know, run a couple miles here and there, you know, start eating salads more, go a little bit more plant-based on the diet, and this stuff should just fall off. A month and a half into just, you know, doing 3 or 4 miles, you know, 3 times a week, it didn't go away. It was like, oh, the metabolism is going. So I was like, you know what? I'll tick up the running. And I just kind of kept increasing. And I had some friends say, hey, maybe you try half marathon. And so my first actual half marathon was the inaugural B of A 13.1. And very similar to a lot of people who are like, I'll never run a marathon. I ran that half marathon. And I was like, you know what? I think I can run a marathon. And so that started the journey that really put me on the trajectory for the last couple of years. First marathon being the Tucson Marathon, which was a wild experience. And super grateful for it because no one ever tells you how much you learn in the first marathon that you run.
Yeah, I definitely know that feeling very well. But actually, I want to ask you about volleyball.
Okay, let's go.
Like volleyball is like something I wish that I had at my high school, but I went to a super tiny high school. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have enough boys to do it. So mm-hmm. how did you get into volleyball? Because like I love playing casually in high school.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh man, I wish we had a team.
Volleyball was it was kind of a stumble upon sport. Very similarly, like it was just getting started really in Arizona. And it was kind of like a mixed bag of who tried out for the team, you know. And I was like, you know what, let's go for it. Not to mention that our girls volleyball team was cute. So like, you know, being able to practice with them and spend more time with them was a ancillary benefit, probably the primary benefit at the time when I decided to delve into it. But, you know, I would say a charisma about it because the technique is everything in volleyball. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be perfect, but you have to be perfect in the way that your body moves to be able to maximize. And, you know, just like any other sport, you start watching the professionals, you start watching the collegiate athletes, and you're just like, wow, this is crazy. It's intense. It's like sneaky exhausting playing it. And I really just really took a liking to it. And not to mention when I was younger, I had some hops. I could jump, but I was terrible at basketball. Like you asked me to shoot. Oh, it's ugly. It's bad. Which coming from a Filipino who is 6 foot, and healthily 6 inches taller than the majority of my family. And by the majority, I mean like bad way to say it, heads and shoulders taller than anybody else. The number one question I would always get asked at family reunions is, so you play basketball? No, I don't. Actually, I'm really bad. So between, you know, having a decent vertical and longer arms, it kind of spoke to me in a way that, you know, you weren't so far behind the learning curve for people that, you know, had been playing basketball since they were 5, 6 years old, organized. And it just gave me a chance to find a sport that, I could jump into that, you know, you didn't have to have that long tail to be able to compete.
This is a fun fact that I don't know if you know, but did you know that the Filipino Basketball Association is like the second longest professional basketball association?
The Philippines are obsessed with basketball, which I think is the funniest thing. 'Cause could we have a shorter race? want to be playing that. But it is, you know, love my culture. And it is just one of those things that everybody is so obsessed with it. That and karaoke.
There's a really good Pablo Torre Finds Out podcast about this guy who does research. He wrote a book on like Filipinos and their basketball love. So they do a whole podcast about it and like the 4-point shot in one league.
Yep.
It's really cool. I'll have to find it and send it to you.
Please do. That'd be awesome.
Okay. So the other thing I was thinking when you were describing volleyball is like when I watch it's, and of course I'm trying to link everything back to running. It's like, there's like an unknown rhythm that's like out there that like, I don't know if the casual fan like knows, like, between you and like everybody else out there?
Especially so I started as an outside hitter, which for the non-volleyball players, that is like your most versatile hitter. It's what they call, like, if it's a busted play or an outlet, and they call it an outlet, really. You're the one that's probably one of the better passers. You're the most versatile, meaning you can kind of hit it anywhere on the court and, you know, make it a pretty competitive shot against the other team. But what ended up happening was one of my coaches noticed that my hands were pretty decent. And meaning my hands were soft. I had a really good control over the ball when I was setting. So I ended up transitioning over to setter opposite. And setter opposite is very similar to like the quarterback. You're kind of determining the plays, you're calling what, you know, hits, what we'll essentially call it routes that your hitters are going to be expecting. You're kind of reading where the defense is before the serve comes in, and getting a understanding of the momentum of how the game's going. So if you guys are on fire, you can do some crazy stuff and, you know, get the really cool plays and runs and sets and spikes in there. If it's not going your way, you got to figure out a way to like adjust the momentum and bring it back to your side. And so I would say for about 2.5 years, that was my role or my secondary role, to kind of understand how the game or the match was flowing, to be able to get my team into the rhythm to make sure that, you know, they were driving towards what we needed to.
And so kind of to relate that to your first marathon, when you said you learned a lot, how have you used some of that mentality with like learning from your first marathon or just running in general?
Well, you know how everyone always talks about don't go out too fast? And no matter how many times you say it, you inevitably go out too fast. And, you know, the adrenaline's going. You're probably in a group that, you know, you're starting with that is pushing what your pace would be anyways. And you're feeling good for the first half. Well, for those that haven't run Tucson, or at least the original Tucson route, because I know they changed it the last 2 years, I think, you're just bombing downhill from like 4,700 feet in elevation to like 2,000 feet in elevation in the first 10K. And so I was flying and feeling good and like, no, like screw my race plan. Like I'm jamming. We're golden. When I say I hit the wall at 22, which impressive that I got to 22 before I hit the wall, but mind you, it was a net downhill course. I don't know that I've ever hit a wall harder than when I hit that, where like even like a false flat felt like I was trying to climb a mountain. And it just, the finish, the last 2 miles is kind of undulating hills. And what I learned was it doesn't matter how good you think you're feeling in the first 10 miles, you gotta reel it in a bit. Because there's something brewing in you that is going to show itself in a nasty way, and you want to make sure not only physically, but you got your mentals ready to meet that thing. And the other side of it was truly understanding how to properly fuel. I was for that marathon, I was fueling based on feel. So like again, I said I was feeling so good for the first half that I wasn't diligent about when I was taking my fuel. I was just like, ah, yeah, I'm good. I'm good. And I remember very specifically mile 18. I was like, I'm hungry. And you know darn well that if you feel hunger on a in a marathon, you're in some deep trouble, my friend. And I was. But all that to say, I still finished. My goal was to finish sub four for my first, and I was. I think it was like 359, 34.
Oh man, that's awesome. You got there. It wasn't the easy way, but you got there. I felt that that hunger feeling once during a marathon. It was terrible.
There's like that almost panic that sets in because you're like, there's no food. I'm not getting any food at any point during this. And the gels, you know, they don't help with the hunger at that point. Like you're done. You're
it's
done.
Too late.
Yeah.
So I ask a lot of this for people who have like a tough debut, even though like physically it was tough, time wise it was great, but. What made you want to keep going?
So I walked probably a mile and a half cumulatively for that. And my next goal was to run a marathon strong. I wanted to be able to run the entire time. So that immediately in my head was like, awesome, you hit your goal. But like next goal is work on your strength through the marathon. And go for it. And really that drove me, towards starting to look at what my time goals were going to be as I started to progress down, because it was just like, if you're going to run it, like run it. And I'll say this, in the healthy runner mindset way, like there's nothing wrong with walking, a marathon or any parts of the marathon or any parts of your long run, like 100%. But that was just one of the motivating factors for me. It was like, you can do this, like run the whole thing.
And then when was Tucson? What year was that?
Oh God, I'm looking at my medals. Was that 2022? Yeah. 2022.
So you're still relatively like new to this kind of running thing.
Yeah. I'm a unhinged puppy. If you, I want to use that term.
What was the second one like when you like eventually like learned from some of those?
Second one was the worst marathon I ran.
Oh no.
Yeah, it was the worst one. So I actually highly recommend the second one for anybody looking for their first marathon. It was Newport, Oregon. So it's on the coast. It's a flat and fast out and back. It was about 3,000 to 5,000 people. So it's small, but beautiful, well supported. And I was like, all right, I got this one because, you know, I'll be able to run it. I'll probably get a decent time. My daughter had the stomach flu the week before my marathon week. I subsequently got the stomach flu the Monday of marathon week. I was in denial that I actually had it. I kind of went down for the count fully on Tuesday. My flight was on Wednesday, to get out pretty early because you fly into Portland and then you drive to Newport, which is about a 4.5-5 hour drive. And when I say that was a really tough drive because you're dealing with the stomach flu after a flight, it was brutal, but I get into the Airbnb and I'm, you know, doing all of the things you're supposed to do, fueling, hydrating, electrolytes, did the shakeout run on the beach, which was really cool. I blew up full body cramps, mile 14, because my body just didn't take any, like did, was not absorbing most of the fuel that was going in, most of the hydration that was going in the days before. And it was a death march for 9 miles, where it was, you know, quarter mile walk, three quarter mile, like super recovery jog. And I just refused to DNF it. I just refused to walk off. I was like, nah, you flew, you did this. Like you're gonna at least cross it. And you know, that was my only medical tent post-race that I've done. But that just from a physical perspective, from a mental perspective, was the hardest, worst race that I've had. But it is on my list of like redemption of at some point, one of these years, I will sign up for it again, because again, it is a beautiful race. It's a great little course. And I just want that one back.
Yeah. It turns out though. Yeah. I didn't realize the second one was going to be much worse.
Yeah.
So I mean, it sounds like, you know, after that I don't want to say rough start, but like not ideal first couple of marathons. Like you've really kind of just come to fall in love with running.
I think having the hard first couple made me fall in love with it more because it was just like it kept the hunger there. Like, all right, like you can do this. I'm also really hard-headed and you like I have a hard time having people tell me I can't do something, let alone myself tell me I can't do something. So, I just kept working at it and honestly did fall in love with it, not only because of kind of the process, like the routine of it is leading up to, you know, racing and, you know, all of the training and then the structure that you go through and, just learning, you learn so much about yourself. Not just from, you know, what's good from a nutrition perspective, like what runs, what workouts do you like the best? First of all, a peanut butter and jelly workout needs to just go away. That one kills me. But, you know, you learn a lot about yourself mentally of like, what are the runs that you like to do solo? What are the ones that you really lean in on people to be running with you to have it be a good run? How do you challenge yourself for doing those runs that you do need, think you need people to join you and be that support that you can do solo to kind of challenge yourself? Like, and you know, it's been something that absolutely has become like a huge part of my life.
And then how did you get into like the content creation side of it? Because like you've like I've seen you like you make some pretty like cool videos on Instagram that I've seen. And you know I know you've got from your you know cooking background to now the project management side, you have a creative you know basically background. How did you decide to do it with running? Because that does add extra time to your life.
It does that extra time. The content creation really came up, and you know, shout out to Justin, because it was a lot of his stuff that inspired me to branch out and kind of engage with the running community in Chicago more. And when I fell in love with that, I was like, I would love to do something similar so that it expands the reach of people. Like, you know, I, because of my network, my outside of running network, having something that you can share that feels accessible, that shows kind of the fun parts, and how running is really for anyone and everyone. And to your point, have that ability to be like kind of creative and try to make something really, really cool or and pop was really that driving force of how can I show and share my love for something with other people and hopefully inspire them to engage in it in the same way. I think it really does harken back, not only from a creativity side, from my culinary side, from my culinary background, but it was also my mantra as a chef, of be able to cook and execute like an elite would, but bring it to the people. Just because you don't have the money to spend to go eat at a Michelin star restaurant doesn't mean that you can't have access to be able to enjoy what that is in your life, because nothing that brings joy should be sacred.
I really like what you said there. I've never thought about it that way, but we're, you know, part of what I'm doing here and part of what you're doing here is we're trying to find ways to make running more inclusive. I'm trying to use the word diverse less because diverse means so many things. So what I mean, that's one way you're trying to make the running community more inclusive. Like, what are some like other ideas, like let's say specifically in Chicago, that we can make it more inclusive.
I think the biggest gating piece that I always hear is I'm not fast enough, you know, so you'll never, I will say, we're not in the business or position to try to solve an insecurity for somebody. But we, as seasoned runners, have the ability to really cheer on and champion all paces and make them feel included, right? I'm going to take a weird pivot to cycling, because that's something I'm very new to, but also has kind of a, it's it's got its gating pieces financially to be able to, you know, participate in cycling, but there's also some negative connotations with attitudes there. Right. And, one of the things that I really like about certain group rides that exist in the city is they call them no drop rides, meaning no matter what your speed is, the group's never going to leave you behind. You're always going to be riding with someone. There will be a sweeper, that'll ride with you. You know, you're never just left alone. I think one of the run clubs that does this the best in Chicago is Westtown Brew Crew. It is a 10 to 10:30 pace. You have a different person leading the group of 30 to 70 through the streets of Westtown. I'm going to use asterisks there because we do travel further than the Westtown boundaries often, but it's self-governing. You've got Boston qualifiers that are screaming, "Hey, slow down. You're not going Brew Crew pace." And I think the reason there is success and that easy barrier of entry for people to, you know, go on a limb and try it is because you have that support of, no, this is for everybody. Like, it doesn't matter how fast you can go on the top end, and it doesn't matter how long you've been running or if you've ever ran a race. Like, just getting rid of that barrier of I'm not fast enough has done wonders. And I think that is the biggest thing. That is what I hear from everybody. Because I hear a lot of people saying, I really want to do this. I want to be able to go run more. I want to, but I'm too slow to run with you, or I'm too slow to run with a group. And trying to figure out what are the best ways to get rid of that insecurity for people that are trying to come in, it really comes down to us that are seasoned runners to really hold that line. If you say all paces welcome, then make them all welcome.
Yeah, no, that's a really great point, because I hear that a lot, and I'll ask somebody to run with me, and they're like, "Ah, nah, you're too fast for me." I'm like, but I'm not running all of my runs at the same pace I would run at 800 or a tempo.
Yeah,
you know, I'm gonna run later today, and I don't know what pace it's gonna be, but I'm just gonna run whatever my body has today. So yeah, I think that is a big way.
Have you seen, I'm sure you have, it's been hitting my algorithm a lot, is the John Carreer, Strava.
Oh yeah.
the goat of, recovery runs. And I've shared that with a couple of people. We have a friend in Denver that's running her first 10K probably in like 5 years or so. And she'd been kind of doing a lot of negative self-talk about like her pace and stuff like that. And I said, listen, you got a guy that has a world record for one of the marathons that averages sub 5 minute miles for 26 miles. And that's his race pace. But you know what his actual recovery pace is? It's what I think my recovery pace is at 9:30. So you're talking 5 minute per mile pace slower than what he races at. So if you ever think that you're not fast enough, just know that your easy run should be easy, and that you would be running with a world record holder at the pace that you're running your easy runs at. So don't discount yourself.
Yeah. It's a really big thing for me. And I just and not even for like newer runners, but just for even the seasoned runners. Like I try to harp on it so much, and like, don't grind yourself into the ground. Like if you have to slow down, slow down. Like we are recreational runners. Like let's enjoy running.
I think that is probably one of the number one things we always talk about during workouts on Wednesdays. Like, we're not getting paid to do this. As a matter of fact, we paid someone to tell us what to do, and they're not even here right now. enjoy it. Like,
I try not to be like too hard on people, but I'm like, man, slow down. Like, it doesn't have to be that quick.
I mean, Bobby will straight up yell at me, and you know, kudos to her because she's gotten me to actually accept what my true recovery pace is, and I've been able to handle that. So, shout out to Bobby.
Gotta love Bobby. Never afraid to tell you what she thinks.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's go back to the upcoming races.
Mm-hmm.
So one, wait, how did, so I know you and Matt run a lot, pretty close. How did you all decide on this plan to do Loch Ness, Chicago, and Tunnel Hill?
So Tunnel Hill, well, Chicago was always on the map, you know, home race. It's always, you know, it's my A race. It was my A race last year. That was my first year running it. It's my A race this year. So that was baked in stone before 2025 even popped up. We'd always been talking about an ultra, because we are unhinged hobby cyclists. So like, you know, we do multiple century rides a year. We have been talking about doing a 200-mile ride over to Michigan and, you know, staying the night and then riding back and doing all this. So we're like, you know what? Hobby one, running, let's do an ultra. So we're like, okay, Tunnel Hill, flat, relatively local. You know, we don't have to get on a plane to go anywhere. Sign up for the 50. One, an unhealthy mental conversation that lasted 10 minutes transformed it into running the 50 miler to let, if we're going to do the 50, let's just do the 100. So that happened in spring. after Boston happened, and we had a pretty busy summer, and we're like, you know, we were talking about doing like a trip, a running trip. And originally we're like, okay, well, let's just like rent an RV. Let's go find a good running trail loop to, you know, train for this ultra. And we'll just do like a running weekend with the boys. And everyone's schedules just didn't work out. You know, those with kids had, you know, the summer plans, all that jazz. So we're like, all right, we're getting close. It's June. What do we want to do for a running trip? We want to get one in before the weather shifts. And I was like, all right, let's just look up like some cool, beautiful international marathons then. Let's go do something. And Loch Ness popped up. It's a really nice point to point net downhill course. I'll report back on how true that net downhill is actually going to feel. And I love Scotland. And I was like, let's see if we can get in. You know, it's kind of close in because it was June at this point and we were able to get in. So we're like, all right, let's check flights. Flights were super reasonable. And we were like, all right, we're going to go for it. So we looked at the training plan and we realized, okay, it's 2 weeks out from Chicago. It's the last 20 miler that we're doing and it's got a workout in. I was like, that's perfect. We'll just run it as the workout and then either add on the bonus mics on the front end or the back end of the workout. And then what a better way to start taper than spending the next 5 days in Scotland and hanging out in Edinburgh and going to do all the things and try your hardest not to go to seven distilleries, and blow up, you know, 14 weeks of training before Chicago. So that's kind of how that one, the Loch Ness one popped up.
That sounds so fun. I personally love running vacations and going somewhere to run a race and then hanging out for a day or two before or after.
Yeah.
It's a good way it's a good way to see the city, like, and not go too crazy while you're in the city. Cause you know,
what's your favorite running vacation that you've done?
I love going to Austin. I don't know if we've talked about this,
yeah,
but I've been to Austin, I think almost 10 times now. Like almost once a year since like 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually, if I'm running or not, I usually go for the half or marathon, yep, the half marathon weekend and President's Day weekend.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a good time to be in the city. It's like the temperature is good. It's not warm in Chicago, so it's like a
Yeah.
good reason to be gone for 4 days. And I just love the food and being down in Austin. So it's my favorite place in the United States that I've been to, just because it's like my kind of vibe. But I don't know if I'd live there, but it's definitely a city that's like I love.
It is one of my top five cities in the US. I lived there for just under 6 years. So that all tracks. Like 100% agree with you.
Yeah. So, and I plan on going back this February if I can, because it's just something I look forward to once a year.
That's awesome.
And then the trip I have done a couple of times, but it's really hard to do, is I've gone San Francisco to Sacramento for CIM, and
Yep.
then I've gone to Seattle once after that. So like that's a Portland. I've gone to Portland after that. So that's
Okay.
another. If you have the time, that's a fun one to do because the flights are cheap and all of those cities are close. So I like doing that one when I can.
Yeah, CIM is definitely on the list.
It's fun. That's another one of those net downhills that's not really net downhill, but it's a good course, and I do think it's fast, but it's not as like net downhill as they say it is.
Yeah, I think it's a great marketing ploy to get more people to sign up. The net
Oh,
downhill. It's like, and then let's check the
my
elevation
God.
map, guys. Can we talk about what that is?
I remember when I first signed up for it, they were like, fastest course in the West. And at the time, I'd never been to California. So I was like, sure, I'll go. And I was like, man, this hurt.
Yeah, it's not in the flattest part of California either. So, like, I think to
No.
your point, unless you're from Central Coast or NorCal, like, you don't actually understand the rolling hill nature that's there. Where, like, I've talked to a lot of people about, the races in San Diego, and everybody knows that that's hilly. And I'm like, it's not that much different up north, guys. Like, if anything, you kind of get sneaky elevation because you're butting up against the Sierra Nevadas.
It's fun. You should definitely do it sometime. And the weather usually perfect. Like
Yeah.
I think I've had like one iffy year where it got kind of warm later in the race, but most of the time it's pretty solid in December.
That's what I've heard. People have also talked about, because it, never rains in California, but there was a one year that it was like muddy.
Oh yeah. I mean, the last time I did it, it was supposed to like historically storm like throughout the race, and then it came early and never rained once during the race. It's like thank God.
You're like, yes.
I got so sick before it. I think I don't know what happened, but it ended up going really well.
That's awesome.
To take it back to Tunnel Hill, well, this is kind of like a two-part question. Well, you mentioned that the running trip and like how nobody's schedules like align, and you're a pretty busy person. You've got a young daughter, and obviously you're married. Like, how do you balance life, work, running, and then all the other fun stuff you like to do?
The easiest way for me is, I have time blocks in my head of my daughter wakes up at 6:30, and I want to make sure that I'm here to, help get her ready for school, and most days take her to school. So I have to get the run in before she wakes up. Otherwise, I have to kind of cross my fingers that I have a gap between 3 and 5 that I can slot a run in. And as well as I do, doing that run in the summer's miserable. And then the only other option is, during the week at least, is after bedtime to be able to get out and do it, which I don't love running after dinner. So what that ends up telling me is, very similar to this morning, it's you just get up early, and get the miles in. On the weekends, it's a trade. Really, it still starts early, usually not 4 a.m., but 5:30, 6 o'clock. And the morning's mine for running. And then the rest of the day, it's either blocking and on dad duty, or it's family time and really leaning in. And what all of this has taught me is it's not necessarily the amount of time that you spend with the family and your daughter. It's the quality of it. Because you could easily just be like, hey, gonna, you know, yeah, I've got 6 hours with the family, but all you did was sit on the couch and watch a movie, or, you know, Bluey for 2 hours. How quality was that? How engaging was that? So it's taught me that, but it's also been wildly informative and educational on long run Saturdays. And the reason I say that is, sure, I could get up at 6 o'clock and knock out 18, 20, 22, 24. But how did I do while I was doing that? You know, I think one of the things that Bobby always said is like, you shouldn't be fried after we have a 20 mile easy. Like, you should be tired, but you shouldn't have to be horizontal on the couch for the next 8 hours because you're recovering. That means you ran it too fast. And I think that's the big difference. You know, I've been with Fleet Feet last year, and this is my second year with it. And that was the big learning was, hey, run slower. Like, it translates over, because just like you said, running is not who I am and everything that I am. It's part of a much larger life that I need to be present for. And so what I've noticed this year is, yeah, I can go knock out a 20 with a workout and then go to soccer and then go to, you know, the planetarium and then go to the park, go to the birthday parties. And then after bedtime, okay, then you can go die on the bed. Like, you know, but like, I'm not a shell of a human afterwards. And so a very complex way to answer your question of time blocking, making sure that the time that you're spending with, you know, the family and the kiddo is quality time and not just dead time. But also being diligent and disciplined about, okay, this is the amount of effort that you should be putting in.
Yeah. And kind of going back to that, one of the things I thought about while you were talking is it's kind of similar with running, where sure, you might miss what I like to call casual runs, because I don't love saying easy runs, where it's like you might miss a casual run, but, you know, did you get some quality miles in,
yeah,
you know, while you're training? I think that's, that's more important than, you know, sometimes just running. So it's like you said, like, you know, did I spend quality time with the people that I care about in my life? So it's, you know, that I see that, you know, correlation there.
I'm so glad you said that, because this literally is a conversation with Matt and I yesterday of like, we're trying to figure out how to get the weekly miles with, you know, this flight coming up. And, you know, I did the workout yesterday and I was like, all right, I listened to my body. I didn't do the full blow of everything because, you know, my calf was bothering me, yada, yada. But I could always do a double and pick up a 5K at the back end of the day. So yeah, it's just, you know, it's 30 minutes, easy to get in there. And when I was talking to him, I was like, you know, like, my body's tired. Like, my calf, I feel like I could benefit from just resting it tonight as opposed to trying to get this last bit. And he goes, well, is it actually going to be quality 3 miles, or is it just an ego 3 miles to get it? Because like, your training plan isn't going to cry that you're missing 27 minutes of, you know, what's going to be a 75 mile week. Like, so like, is it actually, are you going to be doing it because you think it's going to benefit your fitness? Or are you doing it because of your ego? And I was like, that's 100% my ego. Like, what is 27 minutes on a double of a Wednesday workout going to actually do for me here?
And I'm glad he said that, because I know I've had some chats with him. I'm taking it easy.
Yeah, succumb to Kipchoge moments with him of just calm down.
And then along those lines of, you know, these three races, kind of what are your future goals with this sport?
My long-term future goal is personally to get faster and stronger with it. I know there's an expiration date on these knees and ankles that played 7 years of competitive volleyball. And I'm grateful and blessed that they've held up. I think it's the whole, you know, I'm primarily running in a straight line as opposed to zigzagging. I want to get faster. I want to get stronger. I know a lot of people are like, Boston's my goal, like to qualify for Boston. I think it'd be great. I'm not going to kill myself or risk the potential of falling out of love with something that has given me so much over the past 4 years. So personally, it's simply that I do have a goal outside of it, and that's to bring my daughter along on this journey, which I've been successful so far in the last year and a half. I credit that a lot to the running community. You know, I do run with the 6 at 6 crew on Mondays and Wednesdays, and Mondays has been the days that, you know, when the wife's traveling for work, you got to figure out how to get the run in. And she has just taken to it of, we'll bike to the 6:06 and then we'll do the 200 meters run, 100 meter walk, 200 meter run, 100 meter walk. And she's up to 3 miles doing that and loving it and just getting so much support from all, you know, that 6:06 crew, every runner on the 6:06, just cheering her on. And then the balance of the miles after that, she rides her bike with us. So, you know, she did bike the drive with us and clicked off 8.5 miles on the thing, which, you know, for a 6-year-old, I'm just like, that's amazing. You go, girl. And she is genuinely excited and loves when I come wake her up at 5:15 in the morning to go bike and run with not just my friends. I mean, they've become her friends too. So that's my second goal.
I think that's a really awesome goal. And that's a way that, you know, again, you get to spend quality time with your daughter, but you also, in your own way, you help make the active world a little bit more welcoming and, you know, diverse, and bringing it into people who look a little bit more like us. And so it's a nice small way that you can extend that to others.
The ancillary benefit there is, you know, a lot of her classmates' parents run on the 6:06 and see her and, you know, talk about it. And so it's become a topic of conversation of, you know, oh, you know, so-and-so, we tried it because we saw Cece out there. And we saw that you guys are, you know, you're doing it. And, oh, how did you get her started? Like, how should we think about trying that? And, you know, so to the point we talked about earlier is like opening up doors for people that never would have considered, not just their kid running, because you've got to be doing it too. How can you lower that barrier of entry to get more people engaged in it?
That's awesome. Okay. So a couple more questions.
Yeah.
One of the ones I ask pretty much everybody, and you'll be a good one to ask this, but what are some of the things you do for fun outside of, you know, active life?
Outside of active life. I like how you specified the active life part.
Yeah.
So, cooking is 100% like my number one out. You know, when I was actively cooking in kitchens, I didn't really take the work home with me. There's a lot of benefits, you know, you get free wine, free like cool pans, free stuff from, you know, vendors and partners. But now, you know, the people in my life get to enjoy what I'll call the fruits of that labor for 20 years. So I still very much am a kitchen dog. I love cooking. I love trying out new recipes. I love playing with nutrition. And trying to figure that out, and, you know, translating it over to the active sides of my life. And then the second thing is I'm a tinkerer by nature, huge IT nerd. As a fun fact, I was when Geek Squad first started for Best Buy, I was one of the first Geek Squad members of the Phoenix Best Buy in my nice. My neighborhood. I was 15, so I couldn't drive the cool VW Bug to the houses. I just was set up behind the registers working on stuff. So anything computer related or audiovisual related, I'm a huge nerd about. So I think if I'm not spending money on running shoes, it's that.
That part's cool. I definitely relate more into the audio visual side. Although when I went to journalism school, I definitely wanted to do more radio and like radio production. For some reason, like TV and video just never really intrigued me. I
Oh,
don't know.
that's interesting.
Maybe it was the some of the people at Missouri that I'm like, oh, I don't know if I'm gonna deal with them. But like the radio side just seemed more appealing. And like when I'm editing, audio for the podcast stuff, it's just like it's so peaceful to me. And like I can like sit and just do it for hours. And I know it shouldn't take hours, but I feel like I can do it for a long time. And I feel like it just settles my brain.
You know what I've noticed too is, so the wife's got a podcast for kids and I helped her kind of get set up. Also, nice to have like an IT guy in the house to help do the setup. Editing or helping audio edit the podcast is infinitely, and I empathize with you on this one, is infinitely more satisfying than editing a video. For some reason, replaying a video for areas that you're editing just drives me up a wall. I don't know why, but it's crazy the difference for some reason.
Yeah, it in having like a tiny background in college of like audio editing, like you had to basically shoot at like 30 minutes to an hour of stuff, and then you had 90 minutes, 90 seconds, sorry, and you're like, I gotta edit all of this down in 90 seconds.
I mean,
Maybe that's the part that drove me crazy.
to be honest, like when you're doing content for Instagram, that's a lot of very similar of like running and cycling. Like, you have the Insta 360 cameras, the small one on the hat, or the full 360 camera on the bike, and you're just filming, and then you're just sitting there staring at garbage footage to try to find like what is the 30 seconds that's going to slap on this reel. You're like, my God.
Oh no. Okay. I guess we'll make this last question since, we're going on over an hour. But what is like, do you have a favorite thing to cook?
Oh man, I don't have a singular thing that is like my favorite. I have go-tos, because either I've done it millions of times over, or there's something about the technique that I like being able to do, because it all really goes back to like how accessible is it to, normal people. Like I will say that a lot of my background was in Italian cooking. The onset of my career. And then I had, 3.5 years Lebanese. I had 4 years sushi. I had a ton with Sonoran and Mexican because of, being based in Arizona and Texas. So there's like a flurry of things that I've done. But I would say I'll answer your question in a very funny way. If I'm my favorite thing to cook or make, if I'm looking to host or impress someone, I'll dip into the Japanese bag and do sushi or ramen. If it's something where I want comfort food and someone wants comfort food, going French all day. Usually something braised, something that takes a ridiculous amount of time that will be gone in less than 15 minutes. My favorite thing to cook, if it's just easy and want a good meal, which usually is what happens with the family, is I will do pasta, because I can make just tap that training and all that experience pretty quickly, and hammering out a really good dish, that everyone's gonna enjoy. And what kid doesn't like pasta?
Right. And no, I think that's a fair way you broke it down. Like, okay, you have the categories are, that's, I think that's a cool way to answer it. And there's not necessarily one thing, but you're like, okay, if it's this, it's this. And so I, it's,
Well, I love that you say that for the last question, because that's usually the third question people ask me once, when they meet me, is, oh, what's your favorite thing to cook? It's complicated.
That makes sense. And it's, you know, again, correlating it back to running, it's like you have the different workouts on this day you do this, and on this day you're going to want to do that. So there's always, you know, I always try to find a way to bring it back to running and to correlate that.
Yeah, no, that's great. I love the connection.
I think you know this, but I coach cross country.
Yeah.
I try to do it with the kids all the time. I was like, you're going to learn so much about yourself if you just try and fail, and you're going to be like, oh, it was that one workout I did where I didn't think I could, but I ended up doing it. And you're like, all right, maybe I can apply this somewhere else in my life.
I mean, that 80-20 rule, right? Like, you got to let yourself blow up. Cause you learn way more from failing than you do from winning. So the more you fail while you're practicing, the better you're going to show up when you want to go win.
I agree. And that's a good place to end it.
Yeah.
So I just want to thank you for taking time out of your morning to join me.
Yeah.
And then
appreciate the invite.
Of course. Have fun in Scotland. I'll be following along.
Yeah, I've got all the cameras, so we're on a content journey for this one. And one of the things that we're calling it, it's 2025 is the year of the unicorn for Matt, since he ran his first Boston. And fun fact for all of you, the official animal of Scotland is the unicorn.
Whoa.
Yeah. I never knew that. So he's getting two unicorns in one year.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Well, enjoy the rest of your day before your trip. I hope everything goes smoothly.
Awesome. Thanks, Mike. We'll see you when you get back.
Of course. Have a good one.
Thanks, man.
Brian, thank you for taking time out of your day to join me. I really appreciate it. Next up for Brian is the Chicago Marathon. It's just a short tune-up before the Tunnel Hill 100. For everyone else, don't be afraid to DM me a guest suggestion at Keeping Pace Pod on Instagram. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.